Hi, I'm Lydia Brown here with Carmen Baskoff, and we're the producers of Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. We're so glad to have you listening to this podcast, and we hope that you will support the work that we do on this program by giving us a call today. The number is 1-800-584-2788, or you can go online to WNPR.org.
This podcast may be an important part of your routine, so think about the times whether you're on your commute or on a run, all the times you listen to Where We Live and what that means to you. And if that's something you value, give us a call, 1-800-584-2788, or go online to WNPR.org/donate.
And thanks. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Local governments pass many laws, and some of them are meant to keep the public safe. But have you thought about the consequences behind the no loitering signs you see in your town or city? Today we learn how municipalities in Connecticut handle those who loiter or stand around in public spaces with no apparent purpose. Is it a crime? And are ordinances that are meant to prevent loitering effective? Or are they criminalizing the most vulnerable in our communities? Coming up, we'll hear how the city of Middletown has dealt with the issue on its popular Main Street. And later, we'll hear from a homeless couple in New Haven about their experiences. You can join us, too. Does your city or town have a loitering ordinance? Do you think its impact has been positive? You can join us, 860-275-7266. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to welcome our first guest from NPR Studios in New York City, Allison Frankel. She's one of the authors of a 2016 study from Yale Law School's Lowenstein International Human Rights Clinic that looked into how local ordinances criminalize homelessness. Allison is now counsel at the Center for Appellate Litigation in New York City. Allison, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So starting off with a little bit of history, when we think about loitering, when did it start to be seen as a criminal offense?
So these loitering laws are actually a relic from back in the day before the founding of our country. America brought these ordinances over from Great Britain, where they had a series of laws that effectively just circumscribed poverty. These laws were explicitly targeted at the poor, at the undesirables. And America has been applying these laws here since our founding. And as with so many laws in our country, they've really grafted on to race as well as poverty. And they've aimed to keep those that our society has othered and has deemed unworthy away from our streets. So I think it's incredibly important in this conversation when people now talk about the importance of public safety and of beautifying our cities to remember the insidious history that these laws came from.
When we think about criminal behavior, often it's tied to a specific action. But in the study that Yale Law School did, the clinic that you were a part of, you look at how loitering can be tied to someone's socioeconomic status, not necessarily an action that they're taking, but just actually existing in a public space can be an issue.
Precisely. These laws are incredibly vague. For instance, New Britain defines loitering as remaining idle in essentially one location, and it includes spending time idly, loafing, or walking about aimlessly, and shall include the colloquial expression hanging around. That's a direct quote from the ordinance. There's no way to know whether you're violating that law. So people that we spoke to in New Britain and in cities with similar ordinances throughout the state never knew whether their conduct from standing outside waiting for a public library to open, standing outside a coffee shop in hopes of being able to get something to drink would lead to a citation. And one of the problems with laws that are so vague, the reason some have been struck down, is both that nobody knows when their conduct violates the law, and also that they're disproportionately and arbitrarily enforced. I'm sure most people listening to this show have stood on their phone outside of a building, hung around killing some time before a meeting, but only certain people we found are actually cited under these ordinances, and they're disproportionately people who appear poor, people who appear homeless, and people of color.
You mentioned court decisions. So the U.S. Supreme Court, they had a decision back in the 70s that talked about what you just described, where these laws can be too vague and arbitrary?
Exactly. So in a Supreme Court case from the 70s called Papa Christo, the Supreme Court struck down a vagrancy law saying that nobody could tell when their conduct violated this ordinance. And that was really exciting. But states have found ways and cities have found ways to get around these laws. So they started trying to define behavior a little bit more specifically. Some states moved to criminalizing specific activities. So you'll see ordinances prohibiting sleeping on park benches, prohibiting bathing in public, park curfews, things like that are kind of a way to still target this activity while getting around that court case. But others like New Britain and Hartford and the many cities we profile here are still really ripe for constitutional challenge because they are just simply too vague to figure out when your conduct violates the law. There's just no way to fairly enforce what it means to hang around.
I'm speaking with Allison Frankel. She's joining us from NPR studios in New York City. She's one of the authors of a 2016 study from Yale Law School's Lowenstein International Human Rights Clinic, looking at how specific local ordinances, today we're honing in on loitering, can actually criminalize the most vulnerable, especially the homeless in communities. You can join us, too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. You mentioned New Britain. When did New Britain's loitering law go into effect? And the idea that because it's so vague, it could be challenged in the court of law. There's precedence for that?
There is, yes. So this the 1970s Supreme Court case that we discussed serves as precedent. There's more recent cases from the 90s, for instance. In Chicago v. Morales, the Supreme Court struck down a loitering action in Chicago because, again, it prohibited people from gathering in groups and nobody had fair notice of when their conduct violated the law. New Britain's ordinance has been on the books for a while, and New Britain is actually still passing laws that criminalize homelessness. So actually just a couple of years ago, they passed a new aggressive panhandling ban, even though numerous people, homeless activists, social services providers, members of our clinic team went to testify to discuss how these laws are incredibly harmful to the most vulnerable members of our society, not to mention unconstitutional. So these laws are still being passed despite the fact that they violate U.S., state, and international law and really just push down the most vulnerable residents among us.
Allison, in the study, you and others talk to police officers. So those are the people that are the ones that are handing out a citation or summons. What is their take on ordinances that look at loitering, panhandling? Are they effective from the police perspective?
Thank you for that question. So one thing that was really fascinating about our study is so many of the people that we spoke with recognized the futility of criminalizing homelessness and poverty. One officer we spoke to said, you know, it's the definition of insanity, thinking that we can incarcerate ourselves out of this problem. We talked to officers who know the homeless people in their city parks and plaza. They see them technically violating these ordinances every day. They'll issue them a $90 fine. The person who can't afford shelter cannot pay a $90 fine. They end up getting perhaps a warrant issued for their arrest because they don't pay the fine and they can't go to court or don't go to court to tell the court that they can't pay. And then a warrant can be issued for their arrest and they can spend nights in jail. And the cycle just keeps continuing. And then they have possibly an arrest or even a conviction on their record. It's even harder for them to get back on their feet to find housing and to find a job. And the police officers see this. Most of them, you know, didn't go into the police force to tell the homeless man on the street to get up and move. And I think there's a little bit of a lack of creativity in a lot of cities here in realizing, you know, we can't incarcerate, we can't arrest, we can't fine ourselves out of this problem. We have to look at the root, which is housing. We need more housing for people. We don't need more handcuffs for these folks.
Your report also argues, besides thinking about denying people access to public spaces, and if they end up this ripple effect, as you mentioned, where they're not able to show up in court, then they get a warrant for their arrest. That arrest follows them. It makes it harder to find a job or housing. In the report, you argue that these kinds of ordinances violate people's constitutional civil rights. Can you talk a little bit more about that, Allison?
Sure. So there's numerous ways in which these violate our civil rights. First and foremost, these laws constitute cruel and inhumane treatment and punishment in violation of the Eighth Amendment. You simply cannot criminalize necessary life-sustaining behavior. They also violate other constitutional rights. For instance, panhandling ordinances have been struck down, particularly recently, because they prescribe people's speech just because they're poor, right? Someone who's poor and holding up a sign can get cited under a panhandling ordinances, but we have signs asking for things all the time at bake sales and other things. These laws also circumscribe your freedom of movement by prohibiting people from existing in public spaces. And they can violate people's rights to privacy and personal property. We talked to people in cities across Connecticut who are living in tent encampments, and they would come home one day and see that their tents had been slashed and that their few precious belongings had been taken when the police raided a tent encampment that violated a camping ordinance. And just because they didn't have brick walls governing their house, instead it was a cloth tent, that property got no protection and was entitled to no privacy in these police officers' views. So these laws pose very serious questions for people's civil rights.
We know in Connecticut there's poverty everywhere, not just in our cities, but also in the suburbs. When you studied these municipalities in this report back in 2016, what were the ordinances? What did they look like in suburban areas?
Absolutely. This issue is not just an issue for our cities. It impacts suburbs, towns, every place in Connecticut. So we looked at towns and suburbs and cities across the state, and they all had these laws, including the suburbs. So, for instance, Glastonbury prohibits loitering. It has a park curfew. It has a camping ordinance. Trumbull also bans loitering, panhandling, park curfews, camping. South Windsor, similarly. So especially with the increase, as you mentioned, of visible poverty in all of our communities, the city and the suburbs, all our towns, large and small, need to really be thinking about how we treat our most vulnerable residents. Are we enforcing and even passing new laws that push them away, that try to make them someone else's problem? Or are we lending them a hand and making sure our communities are safe for all of our residents, not just the wealthy?
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. My guest today, joining us from NPR studios in New York City, Allison Frankel, one of the authors of a 2016 study from Yale Law School's Lowenstein International Human Rights Clinic that looked into how local ordinances can criminalize homelessness. Now, there's another side to whether loitering ordinances are making an impact. Local businesses don't want people congregating in front of their establishments for a number of reasons. So after the break, we're going to check in on this debate in the city of Middletown. And you can join us, too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We've been talking with Allison Frankel, one of the authors of a 2016 study from Yale Law School's Lowenstein International Human Rights Clinic that looked into how local ordinances that target loitering can actually impact the most vulnerable in our communities. Now, one of the municipalities, there were 38 that they studied altogether, but one of the municipalities that Allison and her team studied was the city of Middletown. I lived there for years, and I know there's been tension over loitering laws on its main street between advocates for the homeless and city businesses. We wanted to know, how are local officials and residents balancing their concerns with an individual's right to be in a public space? So joining our conversation now is Lydia Brewster. She's Assistant Director for Community Services for St. Vincent de Paul in Middletown. And I understand, Lydia, that you help coordinate and run the soup kitchen there on Main Street.
I do. The soup kitchen is one of my main responsibilities there. And the soup kitchen is one of the targets that often comes up in any conversations about loitering. It's something that has arisen from time to time in the now many years that I've been working in the north end of Middletown, which is the lowest income census tract in the city. And it kind of ebbs and flows. I think the concerns about loitering based upon I think the business community that often finds the presence and the visible presence of people who are of low income a deterrent to business, or at least they believe so.
So for residents, I mean, many residents have been to Middletown. Middletown's known for its very engaging Main Street, lots of local shops and restaurants.
Yes.
So as you get further to the Aragone Bridge side of Main Street, that's considered the north end. So St. Vincent de Paul sits closer to that side of town. So when you say that you're often the target because your patrons who are there looking to find a good meal, they stand around on the street, and so the other businesses, are they feeling intimidated? Are they worried if their customers aren't going to come into their stores because of the patrons of the soup kitchen?
Well, I think the north end of Middletown that you described towards the Aragone Bridge has undergone some really wonderful developmental changes in the last particularly 10 years, 10 or 15 years. We've seen some economic development that has improved the neighborhood. We've seen some housing development that have raised the incomes on some of those streets that were had particularly low incomes. But with that also comes concern about that visible presence of people standing outside of a soup kitchen. I should say that there are behavioral issues that take place in front of St. Vincent de Paul. A few people will often create some problems, and we work very hard to encourage our guests to be good neighbors and to behave responsibly both within the soup kitchen and on the street. But sometimes that doesn't work. But I should say that as we look at Middletown that has a very strong restaurant economy, it's always struck me that the men and women that are standing outside of the soup kitchen waiting for lunch, perhaps enjoying a nice day, perhaps socializing and having a good time, why are they different than if you or I, Lucy, went out to dinner with four or five of our friends at one of the beautiful restaurants in Middletown and stood outside and talked about what a great time we had had, laughing and joking and having a good time? That would be emblematic of a vibrant city. But if that happens in front of a soup kitchen, that's emblematic of a city that's deteriorating, which is not true. We are going to be moving our St. Vincent de Paul one block away, so we will not be
right on Main Street.
Right on Main Street anymore, but we'll still be near Main Street.
Now, why are you moving?
Because we have the opportunity to relocate to a site that will be much better suited to our needs.
I wanted to get some perspective from the business community. Joining us on the phone now is Larry McHugh. He's president of the Middlesex County Chamber of Commerce. Their office also sits on Main Street in Middletown. Larry, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
So as we heard from Lydia, we know for years there's been trying to find some kind of way to alleviate tensions that some business owners may feel when certain individuals are congregating on the sidewalk, but also they have a right to be there. So I'm curious, Larry, how the business community has worked with St. Vincent de Paul and the mayor's office in trying to figure out some kind of way that it's not full of tension and that people have a place to go.
Well, I think our major problem is not so much the people in front of different facilities and hanging out, whether it would be there or across the street at the park or down at Spear Park. It is what happens in some cases there, drinking and that assortment of problems that run with that. And the main thing that we get complaints on, even up near St. Vincent's, is the and they have done a good job up there trying to move people and to also clean up afterwards, but would be the nips and other stuff that's left on the streets and more so towards Spear Park, which is at the other end of town. And you know, we feel that everyone says it's the front porch of people that live there and they should have the opportunity to be on Main Street. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with that. But I do disagree with the part of people that are there and then leaving a mess after they leave. The same way I disagree with people when I'm at the Y working out, leaving their towels out and not putting their towels away. I think that's part of, you know, people responsibilities.
So, Larry, if I'm understanding correctly, are these isolated incidents where people are leaving, garbage behind? So this is not something that business owners are contacting you about or the police about if they see people standing around on Main Street?
The only time people contact us is if there is problems arising where threatening remarks are made and stuff like that, then we might get phone calls in here. We ask people to contact us, and then we would contact the police instead of having numerous people calling the police at all times. It's the same thing if it goes to panhandling. Everyone has the right to ask. It's the threatening situation that once you say no, that the people don't continue to harass people asking for money or whatever it might be. At one time, we did pass out cards to everybody, and St. Vincent's was part of that. Also the Salvation Army and Red Cross, that these people would have an opportunity to get services from different organizations. I think Middletown, by and large, is a very inclusive community and really tries to work with both the homeless, those people that need help, and are out there trying to work with them at all times.
Larry, I wanted to bring back our guest to the conversation. Joining us from NPR Studios in New York City is Allison Frankel. Allison, again, you and others at Yale Law School studied 38 municipalities and how certain ordinances are impacting the vulnerable. You also studied Middletown. Can you talk a little bit about how their loitering ordinances may be different from what you talked about earlier with New Britain and what kind of, the way that the community leaders are working together to address this?
Sure. And I just want to say thank you to the other guests on here for raising all of these issues. I think it's incredibly important, as everyone seems to be doing, to work to make our cities safe and habitable places for everyone, which includes our homeless and vulnerable residents, and ensuring they're not being treated differently. So Middletown has a number of ordinances on the books that purely criminalize homelessness, not just this other case-specific behavior that's been talked about here. There's a loitering ordinance, an aggressive panhandling law, a park curfew, a camping law, a public consumption of alcohol. The loitering law is fairly similar to New Britain's. I think it has a lot of similar problems. It prohibits sitting, standing, lying, pacing, or otherwise remaining in essentially the same place and includes the colloquial expression hanging around. So it still has that very vague language there. And the panhandling law as well, while it only prohibits aggressive panhandling as opposed to all panhandling, it's really problematic because the things that it criminalizes are not just, assaulting someone or robbing someone, things that we would think of are problematic when asking for money, right? It's continuing to ask. That's something that people do all the time, whether it's trying to get you to buy something or to support a specific cause, using abusive or profane language, something that's not illegal for a resident to do. But suddenly when they're poor and asking for money, we criminalize that. So I think what everyone's saying about, being able to handle specific situations where someone might actually be posing a public safety threat is absolutely important. But we have laws on the books for that, right? We can call in the police if someone's assaulting someone, if someone's robbing someone. But there's no reason that Middletown needs these laws that we discussed that just criminalize homelessness and poverty on the books to pursue those goals.
Allison, I wanted to bring into the conversation, actually, the mayor of Middletown is on the phone. Dan Drew. Mayor Drew, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be with you.
I'm sure you heard our guest from New York, Allison Frankel, who studied municipalities and how these ordinances can impact vulnerable members of the community. We asked about loitering, and she mentioned Middletown actually has some strict laws on panhandling. I'm wondering if you can respond to what Allison said, as well as do you think the city is doing enough to help the most vulnerable instead of penalizing them?
Yeah, the city really works hard to ensure that everyone has a good and dignified life. I heard Lydia earlier mentioning that St. Vincent's is going to be moving a block over. The building that they're moving to is actually a city building, and we're moving them in at no cost to the city. To the organization. We're turning over the building to them for long-time ownership. Larry mentioned a minute ago Spear Park, which is on the south end of Main Street, where we used to have a tremendous number of problems. rather than bringing the police in and really getting aggressive in that area, we made some physical changes to the park because there were areas that shielded people from Main Street where people were going in to do drugs and engage in some other activity. And we found that when we took the visual obstructions out, the park just automatically kind of got better. Now, people use it, people go there, but we don't have the problems there that we used to. So we try to take that approach. And, you know, especially when it comes to loitering ordinances, loitering is a very ambiguous concept. It's extraordinarily difficult to enforce, and it's really hard to even know what it is. It's one of those things that sometimes you know it if you see it, but not necessarily. And really, the standard that we go by is if someone is obstructing the right of passage for other people. And even then, our officers, if there's a blockage, will only ask people to move on. And generally, we only really get to the point where we're enforcing the law from a police standpoint if we start to run into other problems like drugs or verbal harassment or other issues. But then as I think it was Allison just said, the issue there is a separate statutory violation, not necessarily the issue of loitering.
I'm wondering, Mayor Drew, since you mentioned that you said we're moving the soup kitchen, is this a way to strike a compromise for Main Street? You mentioned the visibility of the restaurants and trying to make customers and business leaders happy?
Well, this really came about primarily because St. Vincent's had outused the space that it has on Main Street. They have a much larger demand for their service than is available there. And it's not just the soup kitchen. They do a lot of social service provision, casework. They need offices so that they can meet with clients on a one-on-one basis. And there are a number of services up in that area that still also exist on Main Street. So this is a more of a holistic approach that's going to do a lot for the community writ large and a lot for St. Vincent's.
And before you go, Mayor Drew, do you think that any of your ordinances should be revised? We mentioned loitering, blocking specific traffic or an entrance. But as we heard from our guest, these ordinances aren't effective. Do you think that the city should take another look?
Maybe. I think maybe for some of them. I'm very interested in Allison's report. I'm going to read it. I haven't seen it yet. And that's something I think to consider. We always try to get better, and when there's more information, we always try to consider that information. What we want is the ability to ensure that everyone has a right to enjoy the public spaces, and to ensure that nobody is put out of those spaces for being on the lower end of the income scale or having a less fortunate situation.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Mayor Dan Drew from Middletown, thank you. Also to Lydia Brewster, Assistant Director for Community Services for St. Vincent de Paul in Middletown, and Larry McHugh, President of the Middlesex Chamber of Commerce. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. We're going to continue our conversation in just a few minutes. We're going to hear from a homeless couple that lives in New Haven. But first, it's our midwinter pledge drive. If you appreciate the conversations you hear on Where We Live and WMPR, please support us. Here are two of my colleagues to tell you how.
Hi, I'm Lydia Brown, here with Carmen Baskoff. We're the producers of Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio, and we want to thank you for taking the time to listen to the Where We Live podcast. We're taking a moment also to ask you to support the work that we do on this program to ensure that it is here for weeks and months and years to come. It's quick, it's easy, and it's secure. All you have to do is go to the phones, 1-800-584-2788, or go online to WNPR.org.
I think one of the tricky things about a live radio show is we are only in one time block, and that might not be a time you're able to listen. So that's the great part of the podcast. You can take Where We Live with you wherever you're going at whatever time. So if that's something that's important to you, something you rely on to learn about what's happening in your community and in the world, the number to call, 1-800-584-2788, or you can go online to WNPR.org/donate. And thanks.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Where We Live's coming to a coffee shop near you. We're hosting coffee breaks at local cafes around the state to hear directly from you what issue or story in your community is not getting the attention it needs. You can join the whole Where We Live team Tuesday, February 26th at the Washington Street Coffee House in New London, Connecticut. You can check out our Facebook page for more information. Now, today on Where We Live, we've been talking about how local ordinances targeting loitering and panhandling have far-reaching consequences for the most vulnerable. Two people who have firsthand experience with this are joining us now from WNPR's New Haven studio at Gateway Community College. I want to welcome to the show Sade and Donnie, who would feel comfortable just using their first names. Sade and Donnie, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Sade, I'll start with you. You and Donnie are both members of the Housing Not Jails initiative of the Connecticut Bail Fund. And as I told our listeners, both of you live in New Haven and you are both homeless. So Sade, tell me a little bit about your experience being homeless in New Haven. Where are you living now?
Right now we're at a warming center because there's really nowhere else to go. It's too cold everywhere else.
And how long have you been homeless?
I've been homeless basically since I was 18.
Mm-hmm. And Donnie, who's with you, you're both your fiancés. So how did you meet?
Go ahead.
Tell them how we met.
I met her last year at the warming center that we're at now. Mm.
So a little bit about the show. We've been focusing on how specific laws in cities like New Haven target the most vulnerable. Since Sade, you've been homeless since you were 18. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the ways that you've felt targeted because you have no place to go during the day? What kind of activity, either staying at the green or standing on a particular street, have you had people talk to you about moving along?
Sometimes, yeah. But I don't stand still too much to avoid that. So it's not really a bigger problem for me. People are not really allowed to fall asleep on the green. Like, we have nowhere to go. Staying at the warming center, we don't get in. They don't open the door until 10 for us to get in. And then we probably don't lay down and actually settle down to go to sleep until 12 or 1. Excuse me. And then they wake us up at 5:00 in the morning just to put us out at 6. So, you know, we're really not getting any sleep. So we're tired and we're exhausted and, you know, sometimes we can't help it if we fall asleep right where we're at. Some of us sit in Starbucks during the day. We fall asleep in there. They'll wake us up. If we keep falling asleep, they'll put us out. The library is the same way. You can't sleep in there. They'll put you out. On the green, it's if they catch you sleeping, the police will wake you up and give you and automatically assume that you're intoxicated. So they'll give you a choice of either going to jail or going to the hospital. It's sickening.
Mm. Donnie, who's with you, understand, again, both of you are members of this Housing Not Jails initiative as part of the Connecticut Bail Fund. As members, you are in support of the City of New Haven passing a homeless person's Bill of Rights. So tell me, Donnie, what you hope to accomplish if this Bill of Rights were passed. How would that change your circumstances?
It would change a lot for not just me and Sade, but for the community. So where we'll be able to vote, we'll be able to use more bathrooms, be able to sit on the green, be able to sit in a library on cold days or when it's raining or the weather's bad, we can sit inside. It would mean a lot for me to get it passed for everybody to have the equal rights, because it's not fair not to have equal rights for everybody.
One of our guests who's with us from New York City at NPR Studios is Allison Frankel. We're hearing some firsthand experiences from two Connecticut residents, Donnie and Sade. They're hoping that a homeless person's Bill of Rights gives them the chance to be able to sit in a public space and not be targeted because of the fact that they have nowhere else to go. Allison, what's your take on these Bill of Rights? Will they help people like Donnie and Sade?
Thank you. I think these are a really exciting development. So this trend started back in around 2012. Rhode Island became the first state in the mainland to pass this new type of document called a Homeless Person's Bill of Rights, which makes clear that just because you lack a house does not mean you lack basic human rights. And this has started something of a trend. Connecticut, as a state, passed a Homeless Person's Bill of Rights in 2013. And it was a really great start. But part of the reason for this movement around a local Homeless Person's Bill of Rights in New Haven is because the state's Bill of Rights is a fairly short document. The local one provides a lot more detail and really addresses head-on this issue of the criminalization of homelessness and makes clear that just because you don't have a place to be during the day doesn't mean that you don't exist. You have to be somewhere. And it makes clear that you cannot be targeted by the police for sitting, standing, laying, using the bathroom, things that are just basic human necessities. So I'm really hopeful that the Board of Alders in New Haven will pass this Bill of Rights and concretize and codify the rights of all of our residents, including those that aren't housed.
You mentioned since Connecticut has a statewide Homeless Person's Bill of Rights, what impact has that had in other municipalities?
You know, I think the impact is really still to be seen. One problem is lack of public awareness. There's been some amazing grassroots advocacy of people holding up the Homeless Person's Bill of Rights when the police enforce them, saying, no, no, I have rights too, you can't do this. But I still think we have a lot to do of getting the word out that this exists, that it has been passed into law, of passing it out and of letting police officers and municipalities know that this is there and encourage them to use that as a floor to build off of and to pass other local homeless persons' Bill of Rights that are more geared towards the issues in their specific areas and to really consider the impact of any laws that they have passed or are considering passing in light of this state Homeless Persons' Bill of Rights.
Donnie, I wanted to go back to you at WNPR's New Haven studio. Can you give us some examples of when you have had interactions with the police because you've been on the New Haven Green, and when what happened?
Yeah, I had gotten a shopping cart, a ticket for a shopping cart on the Green. They gave me, what happened was, the incident was there was a fight that took place, and the cops couldn't figure out what happened or who it was involved, but because we had a shopping cart there on the Green and the cops did not want us to have no carts or nothing on the Green, he wrote me a ticket stating a motor vehicle on the sidewalk. I'm still pending in court about this ticket, and then I questioned the lieutenant supervisor for New Haven PD about the citation, and she said that there's not a cop citation, so local ordinance.
So you still have to show up for court for that. You have a job. So how will that impact you in terms of the scheduling of that hearing?
I lose work. I'm going to lose work for the day just to go to court.
Allison, I wanted to go back to you because we got a comment from a public defender in Connecticut who says that when we talk about loitering, loitering enforcement also affects kids, especially kids of color. Can we talk a little bit about the people, again, that are often where people are calling the police or complaining about certain individuals who are in a particular place?
Absolutely. It's a huge problem in the enforcement of these laws. I mean, as we've been saying, they're incredibly vague. Almost all of us hang about or spend our time idly, going to Yale Law School and being a white woman law student and now attorney. I did this all the time, and I've never received a loitering citation. And I see young kids of color going through the courthouse time and time again for the same behavior. But because their skin it has a different amount of pigment in it because their clothes might be different for those who are homeless or appear homeless because they have other bags with them that shows a status. The cops target them and not other people. And this is a huge problem, and we all need to be paying attention to it because it not only violates our constitutional rights, it violates our basic human rights, and it's simply inhumane and intolerable.
Sade, I wanted to go back to you. You mentioned that often you spend time in a warming center. We hear often from policymakers in Connecticut that the state's making strides with ending homelessness, that there are places for people to go. Has that been your experience? Where are the gaps that still exist in our state?
So there are no shelters for women. Like the only way for, there's no walk-in shelters for women. That's what I meant to say. There's no walk-in shelters for women, but there are two for men. One that is year-round and one that is seasonal. But there's none, period, for women.
So that would be a place where the state could help more in terms of having a place for you to go.
Exactly. Like, for me to get a bed in a shelter, I have to call 211, do a CAN assessment at Columbus House, get put on the waiting list, and then wait for a phone call stating that I have a bed available.
And we just have a couple of minutes left, Sade and Donnie. Tell us what your status is now. Are you close to finding a permanent home?
So we received our housing voucher a few weeks ago, and we are currently looking for an apartment. There are several requirements for this apartment because of certain obstacles that we have to overcome. We have to work with a private landlord because we both have backgrounds. We have Oreo, which we don't have all the paperwork.
This is your service dog.
We don't have all the paperwork to show that he's an actual service dog because we can't afford the tags and the vest and the certificates and the ID. We can't afford all that. So right now all we have is registration for him with a tracking ID number, and he's not registered through the city of New Haven, which is another issue. So and then also, are the utilities have to be included, and this whatever landlord we deal with has to be pet friendly. So, well, you know, those are some obstacles we have to overcome just to find an apartment, which makes it harder to find an apartment.
Yeah. Well, we hope that you're successful in finding a place, both of you, as well as your dog, Oreo. Again, we understand that tonight the Board of Alders is having a public hearing on this homeless person's Bill of Rights. Are you optimistic it'll pass, Donnie?
I hope it passes tonight because we do need it, but I can't force everybody to vote on it because it's their own choice. It's how they see how, where they fit into everything. Mm.
In our experience with the Board of Alders, we have to kind of keep their feet to the fire to get them to do things for us. Mm. So,
well, we thank you for spending some time with us to talk a little bit about your experiences. I wanted to go back to Alison Frankel. Again, just a couple of minutes left. We've been talking a lot about municipalities that have these ordinances, but are there any in the state or across the country that are models for cities and towns when they're thinking about ways to help the most vulnerable, Alison?
Sure. Well, the easiest model is simply to stop enforcing and repeal laws that criminalize homelessness and turn those resources into providing housing for our most vulnerable residents. You know, it costs on average $87 a day to jail someone, but only $28 a day to provide them with shelter. So the best models that we've seen are states and areas that are turning away from criminalization. Rhode Island has been a big leader in starting its Homeless Persons Bill of Rights movement, and we're hoping that there's other reform there. And I think this is really a space where Connecticut actually can be a leader. The state has worked to end veteran homelessness. It's working to end chronic homelessness. We've started a Second Chance Society. We're working on criminal justice reform. And we have to merge these two areas and say, in order to reform our criminal justice system and in order to house our most vulnerable residents, we need to repeal laws that criminalize homelessness. And passing the Homeless Persons Bill of Rights in New Haven is a really great way to start.
Well, I want to thank Allison Frankel again, one of the co-authors of this study that we're going to link at our website, wmpr.org/where we live. She's now appellate counsel of the Center for Appellate Litigation in New York City. Allison, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also, thank you to Sade and Donnie, members of the Housing Not Jails Initiative of the Connecticut Bail Fund. Thank you both for joining us here today on Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Today's producer was Carmen Baskoff. It's also WNPR's winter membership drive. If you appreciate the programs, the people that we speak with on our show each week, please support this show. Here are two of my colleagues to tell you more.